to the Queensbound F local train. The next stop is...
This is the Culinary Historians of New York.
We can get started. I want to welcome everyone to the Culinary Historians of New York March program on the theme of cannibalism. Before we get started, I want to give you just a couple of announcements on upcoming programs. On April 17th, we have Dara Goldstein, who will be speaking on Russian culinary history under the title From Borscht to Blini. It should be a terrific program. Dara, as I'm sure many of you know, is the former editor of Gastronomica and a professor of Russian literature at Williams College, and has written several award-winning cookbooks on Russian food, so it should be a really, really fabulous program. And then on May 30, what will probably be our season finale will be Bruce Craig, Man Bites Dog, Hot Dog Culture in New York, which should be a lot of fun. Bruce has written two books, as I've been told, on hot dogs, and he is a big hot dog fan. He is the chairperson of the Culinary Historians of Chicago and a professor emeritus at Roosevelt University out in Illinois. So his stuff is always very, very well thought out, well researched, and interesting. So I hope you can make it there. I know that the May 30th program is going to be at the Roger Smith Hotel, which is going to be doing a big hot dog display with some push carts and all sorts of things. And Bruce's lecture is the kickoff event for a weekend of hot dog frenzy. So it should be a lot of fun. And then just for this evening, I want to thank all of the CHNY program committee members who were kind enough to help cook some of our very, very creative things. We won't tell you what's been hidden in a few of the dishes. I'll let you, you know, worry about that a little bit. But I need to thank Elizabeth Alston, Carolina Capehart, Elizabeth Field, Linda Lowry, Trudy Lieberman, Renee Martin, Deanne Moskowitz, Charity Roby, and of course the indefatigable Carolyn Vaughn, who is always doing so much work for us. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our speaker, Gary Allen. I guess I probably met Gary about more than 10 years ago with, it was a while. We were both a little less gray at the time, but that's okay. Some of us a lot less gray. Anyway, Gary teaches food writing and occasional food and culture courses at the State University of New York's Empire State College. He does a lot of writing, lots of writing and lots of illustrating. He's constantly, you know, picking away at his keyboard. So he's been the author, editor, or illustrator of, or contributor to, over 30 books. Most of which have something to do with food. His latest books are Herbs, A Global History, and forthcoming Sausage, A Global History. Both of those are in the Reaction Press Edible series, which if you're not familiar with it, you should make an effort to pick up some of the volumes. They're really charming, short biographies of very important foodstuffs, and they're all beautifully illustrated and very nicely produced. He has published a free newsletter about electronic sources of information of interest to food writers. If you're not aware of his newsletter or to read some of his work, you really should, because it's very, very well put together. It's always interesting, and I really highly, highly recommend it. It is onthetable.us, or his blog, justserved.onthetable.us. Anyway, Gary has written two books now on cannibalism. Bruce likes hot dogs. Gary likes cannibalism. That's why we've got him here. One was actually as an editor with Ken Abala on called Human Cuisine, which came out in 2008. And then the most recent book, which is How to Serve Man, on cannibalism, sex, sacrifice, and the nature of eating. This is what Gary's going to be talking to us about. And what's interesting to me is that this book, for those of you who have been trying to write books, it, quote, cannibalizes the print media because it is only out as a Kindle edition. So it is an e-book. You cannot find it in hard copy. Would it ever come out in hard copy? Maybe. Okay. I'm not good with reading on Kindles. It doesn't work so well for me. Anyway. The light is there, and yeah, okay. Well, anyway, without more, let me give you Gary, and I'm sure we should have some very, very interesting information.
Okay, you still hear me? All right. A little background information first about this. I got started on this subject a long time ago. I was reading Margaret Visser's book about rituals of dinner. And in the beginning of it, she was talking about how people think that cannibals must be the least civilized people around, so they must not have any table manners. And it turns out it's wrong. Cannibals are very specific about who to eat, when to eat it, how to eat it, all that. They have very detailed rules. And I started thinking, well, there must be something about cannibalism that I could use as a hook to study all the irrational ideas we have about food. You know, like what we think oysters do for us, and so on. We have a lot of stuff in our heads that's really irrational. So I started looking, and at first I thought, well, there might be some stuff from explorers and maybe some stuff from psychologists. And I just sort of looked through my bookshelves, and I was astounded how much stuff there was. It was everywhere. It was in children's literature. It was in plays. It was in novels. I said, why is that? So I got into digging deeper. One thing I found is that anthropologists break cannibals down into two categories. Endocannibals, people who only eat within their group, and exocannibals, people who only eat outside of their group. I break it down into two more categories. Accidental cannibals, these are all the people who get stranded somewhere and are forced to do it. And what struck me as really interesting about it is that as soon as this happens to them, they start setting up rules for themselves about how to do it to make it acceptable. Like the Donner Party, for instance, would not eat their own family members. They would trade with the neighboring hut so that they would not have to do that. You know, and the movie Alive about the Uruguayan airplane crash, they made it a rule that they were never going to eat any of the women until last thing. I don't know why they did that, but it just struck me as curious. And then I came up with a fourth category, and that's symbolic cannibalism. And that turned out to be the most interesting one of all, because apparently all cultures go through a phase where they were cannibals at some point, and then they abandon it for one reason or another. But they don't abandon the idea of it. So we have all sorts of things. For instance, there's all kinds of slang about I'm going to eat them alive. You're going to be fried in your own grease. You're going to have a roast. All of these things. It just struck me as odd that there was so much of this. There's cannibal children's literature, children's games all over the world, and they almost always follow the same pattern, which struck me as quite unusual. But that's the background. Today is the first day of spring. And we want to celebrate the first day of spring. So a few rituals. Spring is a critical time in the life of a farming society. First, it marks the end of winter starvation. It also places great responsibility on farmers. Crops have to be planted not too soon, not too late, or the entire community will starve the following winter. Limited supplies of seed corn left from the previous year often exacerbate the pressure. It's essential that everything be timed perfectly. Almost every agricultural society has had some form of ritual to guarantee the success of the spring planting. Spring rituals and the initiation rites that mark puberty are obviously about fertility. Sex, eating, death, and rebirth dance together, their movements blurring the boundaries that modern non-mythic peoples use to separate the concepts into more manageable parts. Paul Wurtz described a puberty rite among the Marand Amin of what was then Dutch South New Guinea. After several days of orgies by adults, virginal initiates were brought forward to the middle of the village to a massive structure of logs. One specially prepared girl stayed under that structure and had sex with all the male initiates. While she was lying with the last youth, all the logs came crashing down, killing them. Their bodies were then chopped up, cooked, and eaten by the villagers. The The Liberian Poro Society, up until the 1940s, combined sex, eating, death, and rebirth in their initiation rites. Young men and women were circumcised and the excised parts dried, cooked, and eaten by the initiates of the opposite sex. The male initiation, however, only began with circumcision. It was followed by a long period of isolation, up to 4 years, when the boys were supposed to live in the belly of a crocodile spirit. They received scars that represented passing through its teeth. When the ritual crocodile pregnancy ended, the youths were reborn. The Poro's initiation process overcame their dread of vaginal castration during sex. Brunel Bettelheim saw a connection to the terror of the vagina dentata experienced by some mental patients. He wrote, "The rather unusual custom of eating part of the female genitalia might further suggest inordinate fear of or desire for the vagina, an emotion which is mastered through oral incorporation." Castration, fertility, and the cycle of birth and rebirth are the stuff of myth. Of course, they're not always displayed as obviously as in the case of the Poro Society's initiation rites. Often, they're called upon to serve several functions in the society at the same time. In Egyptian mythology, Isis and Osiris introduced farming to the world. Their jealous brother, Set, tricked Osiris into climbing into a sarcophagus Set had made, then sealed it with the help of 72 confederates, and tossed it into the Nile. The sarcophagus floated all the way to Phoenicia, where Isis eventually found it, sending it back to Egypt. Set, however, was boar hunting in the Nile Delta when the body arrived. He ripped it into small fragments, throwing them far and wide. Isis managed to find all the pieces, except for Osiris's genitals. She reassembled Osiris and brought him back to life, almost. A fish had swallowed Osiris's penis. How does that detail of the myth fit into the agricultural myth? What do anthropophagic fish have to do with farming? Only in Egypt, where each spring the Nile overflows its banks, flooding the fields, would this element of the story make sense. The severed organ, now part of the river, is able to continually fertilize the farmer's fields. This is thirsty work. The absence of genitalia also helps to explain this new role as Lord of the Dead. The realm of the dead is the reverse side of the living, reproducing world. You may recall that Persephone, daughter of Zeus and Demeter, had to stay with Hades in the underworld because while visiting, she ate a pomegranate seed. Pomegranate seeds were a symbol of fecundity in ancient Greek and other Mediterranean cultures. After a time, when Demeter prevented the crops from growing, Persephone was permitted to spend half of each year above ground, the Greek explanation for the ever-changing cycle of seasons. A myth of the Marind Amun of Seram, New Guinea, contains hints of the Osiris story. In it, Admeta kills a boar and finds a coconut stuck in a tusk. He planted it, and 6 days later it flowered. When he cut a flower, he accidentally dripped some blood on it. That blood became the girl child, Hanueli. When she grew up, she stood in the dancing ground giving gifts to the dancers. However, the dancers killed her and buried her there. When Admeta discovered the murder, he disinterred her, cut her up in small pieces, and buried them in many places. He made a doorway to the dancing ground out of her arms, and the dead Hanueli called upon the murderers. Quote, "Since you have killed," she said, "I will no longer live here. I shall leave this very day. Now you will have to come through me, through this door. Those who were able to pass through it remained human beings. The others were changed into animals, pigs, birds, and fish, or spirits. After her going, men would meet her only after their death, and she vanished from the surface of the earth." Here again is the murdered god, the dismemberment, the pieces of the body that yield the foods of later mortals. The source of human mortality is directly connected to an ancient ritual that is, simultaneously, the source of human nourishment. Killing and eating are inseparable. The package is tied up even more neatly by the reuse of Hanueli's arms. The woman's arms become the entrance to the afterlife, the only way to approach divinity. The embrace of physical love is a metaphor for death and transfiguration. People once believed that their kings were closer to the gods, or that the kings actually were gods. However, the crowns worn by kings were originally used to mark sacrificial animals. Again and again, in culture after culture, we see that the sacrificial animal or person, crowned and decorated as royalty, or rather, that royalty is crowned and decorated like sacrificial victims, that are then killed that others might live and prosper. Euripides has Iphigenia in speaking of her approaching death on the altar of Artemis, alluding to the process. As the priest takes from the basket the barley, so may the fire blaze with the meal of purification, and my father will turn to the right and encircle the altar, put on my hair a wreath of garlands, and on my head a crown. While she saw herself as a means for others to live and prosper in a general sense, most of the ritual sacrifices were intended to literally increase the yields of agriculture. Originally, the kings of ancient Egypt served for 30 years, then were sacrificed and eaten at a feast called Sed. This was supposed to guarantee the fertility of the fields and the power of the next king. Over time, no doubt at the urging of later kings, other animals began to be sacrificed instead. Curiously, certain Hebrew demons were called Sedim. In the worship of Moloch, children were sacrificed to appease the Sedim. A revisionist mode of thought, similar to the stories of Isaac and Iphigenia, you all know the story of Isaac? The interesting thing about that is that at the very moment he's about to be sacrificed, he's whisked away and a ram is put in his place. The same thing happened with Iphigenia. At the moment she's supposed to be sacrificed, a deer is put in her place and she goes off to some holy place where she lived out through the entire Trojan War in Egypt someplace. The reason for those things is because both of those stories were revised after people gave up sacrifice and cannibalism. So the stories were older in a different version. So according to some scholars, Moloch of the Old Testament was neither Milcom nor any of the other several other foreign deities who had similar names, such as Moloch, and were worshipped in neighboring regions. Rather, it was the Jewish god Yahweh himself that human sacrifice was offered. Later, Israelites apparently were so appalled by the practice that they tried to blot out their shame by changing the name of the god from Yahweh to Moloch, or Molech, as though human sacrifices had been offered only to a foreign deity. Religions, as they evolve into or are replaced by new religions, must suppress the old ways, even if they are the ancestors of the new. At the same time, the past essential character must be incorporated so that nothing important is lost, just like the spilling of blood beside the altar so that no life can return to its holy source. We know that meat eating is intimately tied to notions of sacrifice and that the life taken is essential to the continued spiritual life of those who consume it. What happens when non-believers eat the meat of sacrificial animals? Certainly there's no incorporation of the sacred, but might some other kind of sin be involved? For instance, if an animal is sacrificed to a god in whom one does not believe, does that act of eating its sanctified or transubstantiated flesh constitute an unauthorized act of theophagy? Does eating such flesh in some way give authority to any idols to which the sacrifices were made? Christ equated the eating of meat sacrificed to idols with fornication. However, St. Paul hesitatingly disagreed. He wrote, "As concerning, therefore, the eating of those things that are offered and sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and there is none other than God, no other God but one. So, if the gods are false, there can be no recognition of them in the mere eating of their sacrificial meats." However, he continued his argument, "Meat commendeth us not to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, neither if we eat not are we the worse." He's in effect denying that some foods carry a magical burden, that eating them cannot be a path to the sacred. This is a rather odd position for St. Paul to take, considering that he was the founder and promoter of a new religion whose central ritual is the magical transubstantiation of mere bread and wine into the flesh and blood of God. You knew I had to get here. Communion. The Christian ritual of communion is perhaps the most obvious example of symbolic cannibalism. Christ, warming to the idea of self-sacrifice, offered himself metaphorically to his dinner companions. The Last Supper was a kind of living will in which Jesus bequeathed his legacy to the apostles. His acquiescence to fate and elevation to a greater spiritual significance actually occur at that moment. The passion on the cross can be seen as a mere formality, the logical conclusion of the promise made with the symbolic flesh and blood. The Romans were not indulging in any spiritual activities. It was purely a political act of expedience, although it appears that they did take some pleasure in it. Crucifixion was derived from a Carthaginian sacrificial rite that the Romans adopted and used mockingly against their defeated enemies. Later, they applied it widely to low-class and non-Roman felons. Christ himself is mocked as a Jewish king by the crown of thorns and the inscription INRI. The Roman treatment of Christ can be seen as the degradation of a fallen king. The story of the crucifixion of the King of Kings can be seen as the last in a long line of kings sacrificed according to the rules of ancient fertility cults. It may have been coincidental that this particular sacrifice took place so close to the vernal equinox, but that fact only made it easier to graft the growing Christian mythology onto older, tried and true myths. When Paul, on the analogy of the mystery religions, evolved the myth of a savior who should die, be eaten, and rise again, he felt that the only explanation of the mysteries necessary was the story of Jesus. But as times changed and the church expanded and began to take in learned and intellectual men, the myth was no longer all sufficient. The fundamental idea of the absorption of the deity by killing and eating it became less obvious. Men began to speculate on how the bread and wine could be the very body and blood of the immolated God. And thus, turning to Aristotle or to other philosophers, they evolved the dogma of transmutation. The Eucharist, like the traditional Easter leg of lamb, is a symbolic eating of the Agnus Dei. According to Roman Catholic doctrine, the bread and wine are actually the flesh and blood of Christ. They are transubstantiated. The Roman Catholic Church does not accept the Eucharist as a symbol. It believes that beneath the surface appearance of this food is actual divine flesh. In the 13th century, everything possible was done to make vivid to the people the reality of the body and the blood. Thus the bread was made in the image of a man and pierced by the priests, just as the great god of the Aztecs had once been treated. Hot water was used to increase the resemblance of wine to blood. The Catholic Church was neither the first nor alone in believing that genuine transubstantiation occurs. Transmitted through the Orphic mystery cult, the tradition of partaking of the torn god's flesh and blood entered in a sublimated and symbolic form into the rites of Christianity. Even in the 16th century, men were excommunicated from the Lutheran Church because they denied the doctrine of ubiquity, the physical presence of the body and blood of Christ in the consecrated host. In the Byzantine Church, the Eucharist used to be cut from the center of a special loaf of bread. That piece was known as the lamb. The lamb was cut into a series of smaller pieces and a series of symbolic shapes and arrangements. No crumb was lost or wasted. The lamb, or body of Christ, was not the only person that was eaten, however. Pseudo-Germanus considered the entire loaf as a symbol of the body of the Virgin Mary. From this body, he tells us, the Lord has been extracted. The remaining part of the loaf, which he specifically called bread of the body of the Virgin, is distributed to the faithful. Mary was considered to be the symbol of the church, so it may again be supposed that the symbolic distribution of her body meant communing with the body of the church. The Eucharist was not always the tiny, non-nutritive wafer we see today. In fact, communion used to be part of a love feast in which all participants received real food. Libations over sarcophagi led naturally to ritual meals over the tombs of the Christian martyrs until, that is, St. Ambrose in the 4th century forbade them and substituted the symbolic meal of the Eucharist. Massimo Montanari wrote about the bread-body metaphor in the early Christian church. A sermon of Augustine explained in careful detail the metaphorical analogy between the making of bread and the formation of a new Christian. This bread retells your history. It began as a seed in the fields. The earth bore it, and the rain nourished it and made it grow into a shoot. The work of a man brought it to the threshing floor, beat it, winnowed it, and put it in the granary, brought it to the mill, ground it, kneaded it, and baked it in the oven. Remember that this is also your history. You did not exist and were created. You were brought to the threshing floor of the Lord and were threshed by the work of the oxen, or so I shall call the preachers of the gospel. While awaiting catechism, you were like the grain kept in the granary. Then you were lined up for baptism. You underwent fasting and exorcism. You came to the baptismal font. You were kneaded into a single dough. You were cooked in the oven of the Holy Ghost and became the true bread of God. The essence of bread was, however, Jesus Christ himself, planted in the Virgin, fermented in the flesh, kneaded in the Passion, baked in the oven of the sepulcher, and seasoned in the churches where every day the Holy Host is served to the faithful. The idea of transubstantiation achieved the status of reductio ad absurdum in the 13th century when Hugh, Bishop of Lincoln, later St. Hugh of Lincoln, was viewing a sacred relic at Féchamp, the desiccated arm of Mary Magdalene. He shocked those present by taking a bite out of it, but defended his actions by saying, if he could touch the body of Christ in the Mass, he could certainly apply his teeth to Mary Magdalene's bones. Christ was the incarnation, literally God in the form of meat, and the fruit of Mary's womb. There's a nice symmetry in Christ beginning and ending as foodstuffs for our nourishment. Is it a coincidence that the infant Jesus, destined to be eaten, was laid in a manger, a feeding trough for animals named for the verb to eat? When the Magi visited the infant Jesus, they came bearing gifts. Today we think of them only as precious gifts suitable for a young king. However, at the time they carried immense symbolic value as well. Gold, obviously, was expensive, but it was also the color of the sun, and Christ was the new incarnation of the solar deities, like Apollo. The most significant attribute, the characteristic that makes it desirable as a form of currency, is that it's incorruptible. It does not rust or waste away. It is eternal, just like the young deity. What about the other two gifts, the frankincense and myrrh? Though the whole range of spices is used for culinary purposes and in aphrodisiacs, it was frankincense and myrrh that we used almost exclusively for sacrifices and in funeral preparations, for anointing the bodies and masking the sense of decomposition. Of course, the three wise men could not predict that the boy they visited was destined for sacrifice. In all probability, they themselves never existed. They functioned in the story to connect events from the life of Jesus to existing mystical ideas. The Gospels were written more than a generation after the crucifixion and were molded by Paul's vision of the new church. By then, Paul had reconstructed the story of Jesus' life to fit as closely as possible the ancient prophecies and mythological structures that were the lingua franca Eastern Mediterranean spiritual life. All religions build on fragments of previous religions, as ancient cities are built on the rubble of still older cities. St. Peter's in Rome stands upon the spot where ancient worshippers of Attis sacrificed bulls. Muslims and Jews still fight over the Dome of the Rock, the supposed site of Isaac's near sacrifice. Both Artemis and Mary were virgins who were known as Queen of Heaven, and both, despite their virginity, were associated with childbirth. In Ephesus, the ruins of Artemis's great temple stand nearby the church that marks Mary's grave. The Jesus story sounds very much like that of the Bacchus Dionysus of the Orphics, or of Adonis Osiris of the Hellenistic Egypt, or even Sumerian Tammuz. That's because the basic ideas were in place, waiting, as it were, for incarnation. Dionysus was believed to be actually within the substance of the wine and raw flesh that the worshippers consumed. A Persian Mithraic text reads, "He who will not eat of my body and drink of my blood will not be made one with me or I with him. The same shall not know salvation." Dionysus, like Christ, was sacrificed and saved his followers through initiation into his mysteries. Did he not appear in the communal feast of his initiates as the model of those gods who offer themselves as victims of sacrifice? Are you hungry now? I expect a lot of questions. No questions, because everyone here has eaten human flesh. I have, not to my knowledge.
But what would it be like if you were to eat human flesh? The taste.
Well, some of us are chicken. Actually, there's a whole section of that in the book, of course. And I knew someone would ask that. And just in case, I primed Kathy. In the 1930s, there was a French diplomat named Paul Morand, who was also an explorer, and he knew a writer named Seabrook, William Buller Seabrook. And Seabrook had written some books about odd things. He wrote the very first book in English that used the word voodoo. He wrote all kinds of strange travel books. But when Morand went to him and realized that Seabrook had the requisite verbal skills, and he suspected that he had the courage needed for a special task. That task was to find out what human flesh really tasted like. He smoothed Seabrook's way with equipment, letters of introduction, transportation, everything he would need. He believed that the opportunity for such a trip was fast disappearing, telling him, "You must get yourself invited to dinner with the cannibals." It made perfect sense to Seabrook. I made up my mind before leaving New York that when it came to the subject of cannibals, I would either write nothing whatever about them or I would know what it was I was writing about. His book, Jungle Ways, examined our subject in greater detail than most of us would admit wanting to know. Seabrook spoke with the Guare tribe, this is in the Ivory Coast, and after asking about their source of human flesh, he posed a basic question. To my asking why they ate it, they returned the question back to me, saying, why shouldn't we eat it? Rather than beginning with taste directly, he asked which parts they preferred. They replied that for solid meat, the loin cuts, the ribs, and the rump steak were the best. The liver, heart, and brains were tidbits, but tasted identically the same with those of other animals. As a matter of personal choice, the palm of the hand was the most tender and delicious morsel of all. They said that the flesh took long, slow cooking to tenderize, but that was because they only ate mature men, other warriors, exocannibals, that they killed in combat. Convinced that he was in the company of cannibals and knowing the rarity of such experiences, he felt in duty bound to make the most of it. He received a portion of stew with rice, so highly seasoned with red pepper that fine shades of flavor might be lost to an unaccustomed palate. However, the Guare were wary of this white stranger and feared retaliation if the authorities learned of their cannibal feast. Seabrook later discovered that they'd served meat from an ape, not a man. He left Africa without achieving his goal, knowing he would have to write about the experiences as if he'd been successful. He went to France to write the book where he solved his problem. A friend obtained for me from a hospital intern at the Sorbonne a chunk of human meat from the body of the first healthy human carcass killed by accident that they could dispose of as they chose. I cooked it and ate it in the presence of witnesses. Seabrook understood that the experience was limited by its cultural context, specifically the cooking itself. He decided to isolate the part of the meal that was truly unique. He knew what he had to do. Seabrook's writing hesitated at this point, as if at a threshold. If ignorance is bliss, there can be no return to the Garden of Eden after stepping outside. He was a gentleman, and he was giving his reader one last chance to avoid taking that step. This is the time you want to leave if you want to. The raw meat, he wrote, in appearance was firm, slightly coarse textured rather than smooth. In raw texture, both to the eye and to the touch, it resembled good beef. In color, however, it was slightly less red than beef, but it was reddish. It was not pinkish or grayish like mutton or pork. Through the lean ran fine whitish fibers, interlacing, seeming to be stringy rather than fatty, suggesting that it might be tough. The solid fat was faintly yellow, as the fat of beef and mutton is. The yellow tinge was very faint, but it was not clear white as pork fat is. In smell, it had what I can only describe as the familiar characteristic smell of any good fresh meat of the larger domestic animals. Preliminary observations completed, Seabrook continued the experiment. Once again, he tried to limit the variables that might obscure the facts he was after. He prepared the steak and roast in the simplest manner, as nearly as possible as we prepare meat at home. The small roast was spitted, since an oven was out of the question, and after it had been cooking for a while, I set about grilling the steak. I tried to do it exactly as we do at home. It took longer, but that may have been partly because of the difference between a gas flame and wood coals. He did not say how he determined the cooking time. His perception of elapsed time might have been altered by the extreme nature of the experience. His cooking observations continued, however. When the roast began to brown and the steak turned blackish on the outside, I cut into them to have a look at the partially cooked interior. It had turned quite definitely paler than beef would turn. It was turning grayish as veal or lamb would, rather than dark reddish as beefsteak turns. The fat was sizzling, becoming tender and yellower. Beyond what I have told, there was nothing special or unusual. It was nearly done and it looked and smelled good to eat. Some readers at the time were bothered by the very thing that fascinates us, Seabrook's logical and dispassionate exploration and exposition of a subject most people consider the stuff of nightmares. An editorial in the Montgomery Advertiser summed up the general response. It is not agreeable to think that an intelligent, educated member of the white race and of the American nation had voluntarily descended to a scale lower than that observed by these lowly peoples. And not the least repugnant feature of this indescribably sordid affair is the levity, almost the pride, with which Seabrook has recounted to the representatives of the press his adventures in a new experience. Seabrook responded with justifiable annoyance. Those who might have forgiven me for eating an N-word couldn't forgive me for eating with one. This was no monster, devoid of human feelings. Seabrook was a sensitive, intelligent person who had willingly put himself in one of the most psychologically challenging positions imaginable. His description of the experience. I sat down to it with my bottle of wine, a bowl of rice, salt, and pepper at hand. I thought about this and planned it for a long time, and now I was going to do it. I was going to do it, furthermore, I had promised and told myself, with a completely casual, open, and objective mind. But I was soon to discover that I had bluffed and deceived myself a little in pretending so detached an attitude. It was with, or rather after, the first mouthful that I discovered that there had been an unconscious bravado in me, a small, bluff-hidden, unconscious dread. For my first despicable reaction, so strong that it took complete precedence over any satisfaction or any fine points of gastronomic shading, was simply a feeling of thankful and immediate relief. At any rate, it was perfectly good to eat. At any rate, it had no weird, startling, or unholy flavor. It was good to eat. And despite all the intelligent academic detachment with which I thought I was approaching the experience, my poor, cowardly, and prejudiced subconscious real self sighed with relief and patted itself on the back. So he did it. Without any external compunction, no famine, shipwreck, siege, or plane crash, he became a cannibal. This was almost 50 years before Aaron's assertion that there never was a reliable eyewitness to any kind of non-emergency cannibalism. Can a more reliable eyewitness be imagined? Still, we're left with the nagging question, what does it taste like? Seabrook has not finished with us. He wrote, I took a big swallow of wine, a helping of rice, and thoughtfully ate half the steak. As I ate, I knew with increasing certainty what it was like. It was like good, fully developed veal, not young, but not yet beef. It was very definitely like that, and it was not like any other meat I'd ever tasted. It was so nearly like good, fully developed veal that I think no person with a palate of ordinary, normal sensitiveness could distinguish it from veal. It was mild, good meat, with no other sharply defined or highly characteristic taste, as for instance, goat, high yam, or pork calf. The steak was slightly tougher than prime veal, a little stringy, but not too tough or stringy to be agreeably edible. The roast, from which I cut and ate a central slice, was tender, and in color, texture, smell, as well as taste, strengthened my certainty that of all the meats we habitually know, veal is the one meat to which this meat is accurately comparable. As for any other special taste or odor of a sort which would be surprising and make a person who had tasted it not knowing exclaim, what is this? It had absolutely none. And as for the long pig legend, repeated in thousands of stories and recopied in 100 books, it was totally, completely false. It gives me great comfort here to be able to write thus categorically. When word of Seabrook's deception by the Guerre leaked out, the press had a field day with the news. He could not, of course, reveal his real supplier of human flesh, so he had to endure the laughter from all of France, almost all. Seabrook has one last surprise for us. Daisy Fellows, who was heir to the Singer sewing machine wealth, and I believe she was also the editor of Harper's Bazaar in France, came to her with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. and said, it was just too bad, you poor credulous little boy, and with all the trouble you took, I think you deserve to know what human flesh really tastes like. So I'm giving you a dinner next week in my garden. Out on the lawn marched the major domo, followed by lackeys in knee breeches and white gloves, bearing a charcoal brazier, silver dishes, and a platter of meat cut up to be grilled. We ate it and liked it. It looked and tasted exactly like fully developed veal or fine young beef. In other words, it looked and tasted exactly like human flesh.
And where is that from?
That comes from two places. That comes from his book, Jungle Ways, three places, actually. It comes from his autobiography. And there was another book that his wife wrote. She was a witness to this.
Not a participant.
No, she was not a participant. In fact, the first meal they had was at a mutual friend's house in Paris. And the woman of the house was out of the house at the time, and she was a vegetarian and a teetotaler. And she came in while this was happening, And first she was horrified that there were people drinking and that they had meat in the house. And then she found out that this was some unusual thing and she wanted to taste it. And Seabrook's wife said, no, this is unspeakably nasty. You don't want to do this. So she, the vegetarian, never actually tasted human flesh. Yes?
So despite the fact that as Christians we have this sort of symbolic idea of eating flesh and drinking blood, I'm sure every Christian, sort of, as a lapsed Presbyterian, I can tell you the last thing they would admit it to is cannibalism.
Right.
But despite that symbolic history of that, aren't we really talking about a very tiny group of people who have somehow gotten off the track of the human race? I can't think of any taboo that you could have in every, the Taliban, the North Koreans, there's a group of people who would agree that this is an acceptable thing to do. So when we're talking about this, we're talking about people who are somehow off the track, aren't we? They're somehow not gone with the evolution of the human race?
Yeah. What happened is around the time that we developed agriculture, what some people call the megalithic period, the time when people were making huge stone monuments like Stonehenge and things like that. Around that time, people abandoned human sacrifice and cannibalism and went another direction. We were talking about Marvin Harris earlier. Marvin Harris is an anthropologist who has studied largely the economic aspects of societal rules. And what he decided is that at some point along the way, we decided that it was more efficient not to eat the people we captured, but to make them slaves and make them have them make food for us. It was an economic decision. Much as all the argument now about horses, eating horses, or eating dogs. We don't want to do that because we've made them part of our family and all that. We've taken them out of that range.
The abandonment of slavery was an economic decision in large part, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So what we've done is we didn't really abandon slavery until we started to get machines that would do the work. Again, it was an economic decision. It wasn't a moral decision.
But what about the Indo-cannibals that are eating within their own
group?
Oh,
yeah, they're very interesting. Some people call that love cannibalism. A perfect example would be where your grandmother dies and you cremate her and you take her ashes and put her in some soup and then everyone in the family has some of it as a way of keeping her essence in the family. There are many stories like that around the world. There are different groups that have done this. You were talking about that it's only a small group of people. It's a small group of people who haven't gone past that megalithic phase yet. So in New Guinea and a few other places, there are still remote people who have not gone on to the next stage. So they do it. If you look at old myths, old creation myths, almost all of them have cannibalism at the beginning. You know, Kronos ate all the other gods because he knew one of them was going to overtake him. So Zeus was hidden elsewhere, right? So after all that stuff happened, all the other gods got back out and Kronos was in fact deposed and Zeus became the leader. There are stories like that all over the world. And we keep them as an essential part of our mythology. I'm curious as to why. And the reason is because it's back there somewhere. You have a question on this?
With the etymology of where cannibalism?
Oh, very simple. Before that, before Columbus came to the New World, the word was anthropophagy. People eating in Greek. The word cannibal is a corruption of carib, or cannibales, which is the way the Spanish heard the term, because when they got to the Caribbean, they kept hearing about these other terrible people that ate human flesh. We were talking to the gentle people here, but they were all afraid of these other people over here who are cannibals. If you look around the world, it's always the other is the cannibal. If you read like Melville's Taipei, he jumps ship with a friend of his, and they live with these cannibals on this island. And the cannibals are always saying, oh, Hapur, horrible people. They eat people. They eat people themselves. But it's always the other is the cannibal. And it's still everywhere. Yes?
My grandfather was a medical missionary to South America.
Okay.
And when World War II broke out, he was summoned home. And on his way home, he stopped at my other grandfather's house for a celebration of his return to the United States.
Right.
My other grandfather had his favorite dish was barbecued goat.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my grandfather, sir, invited everybody in the neighborhood, and everybody came to have his goat, and he noticed that my South American grandfather was not eating.
Yes.
And so he stood up and he said, well, Daniel, said, why are you not, this is my favorite dish, why are you not eating? And so Daniel stood up and he thanked the Lord very much for the meal. And then he said, frankly, it tastes sweet and too much like human flesh for me.
Yeah.
And every fork in the plate.
Yeah. So you say he didn't believe in eating kids. No, actually, one of the earliest accounts of cannibalism in the New World came from a seaman named Hans Staden in the 16th century, who was captured and lived among the Tupinamba in what is now Venezuela. And they were exocannibals. What they did is whenever somebody died in their group, they believed that somebody in the other village was responsible, whether it was through magic, through warfare, through murder, whatever. Somebody over there was responsible, so we need to eat him. So they would capture somebody, and they would bring him over to their group, but then they became a kind of endocannibals, because what they did is they took that person and treated him like the most honored guest imaginable. They gave him the wife of the person who died in their village, and he lived with her for years. They treated him like royalty up until the day they beat him to death and ate him. So they, in effect, made him one of them in order to eat him. Yeah. There's a great story by, what's her name, Claudine Vassas, who did a thing on the symbolism of the pig. And in it, she talked about how pigs are fairly intelligent and they were part of the family. But in what they used to do is take the pig a few weeks before it was time to slaughter it, and they would put it in this tiny little box, and they wouldn't feed it, and they would poke it, and they would torture it until it became vicious. And then they had to kill it to protect themselves, right? It's like Buddhists believe that you can eat meat, and you can eat eggs and things if you're not responsible for the death of the thing. So, when you go to grocery stores that serve Buddhists, they always have a special box over here of eggs that were accidentally cracked, because you're not responsible for the death of those eggs, so you can eat them.
Right.
You know, I mean, we do the same thing. We wrap it up in styrofoam trays, making all traces of whatever it was disappear, so we get allowed to eat it. Yes?
Have you looked into, I mean, there's obviously Hansel and Gretel, but are there other
European everywhere, folktales? Oh, folktales all around the world. Everywhere. And they often follow the same pattern. You're familiar with the Odyssey, right? Do you remember what happened when they're all locked up in this cave with the Cyclops has sealed them in? The Cyclops, he is not human. What makes him not human is that he eats the meat raw. It's embarrassing, right? So what Odysseus has to do is he has to trick him. He does that whole thing where the Cyclops asks him his name, and he says, my name is Nobody. And then when he gets away, the Cyclops is yelling, Nobody is getting away, Nobody is getting away. And of course, they say, oh, Nobody's getting away, fine. So what he did, what Odysseus did, is the same thing that Hansel and Gretel did. They outwitted the cannibal by tricking it. They would put out a little stick, and she would pinch the stick and say, oh, well, not fat enough yet. So in all those stories around the world, and they're in Zulu stories, American Indian stories, all over the place, what happens is the child outwits the cannibal by using logic and reason, the thing that makes him human. By using that, he goes to the next level and is able to escape. And they're always the same story all over the world.
Well, is there something about blindness, though, with the cannibals who cannot see? I mean, isn't the Cyclops somewhat, he's been blinded by the time Odysseus
I have to think about
escaping.
That. I have to think about that. There's
the witch,
blindness doesn't...
can't see and is just...
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. Because in a sense, what they're doing is the children's stories are recapitulating the development of cultures. We were cannibals. Somehow reason and logic took us out of that, and that's our escape into the modern world. So they're the same story. But I don't know, blindness is interesting. I'm going to have to think about that some more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of those stories about slitting the stomach open and eating them out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there is Little Red Riding Hood, obviously, but there's, I know...
Peter and the Wolf?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. And in my background, there's a story about, a Czech story about a little child who starts eating and eating and eating and eating. His parents eat the entire village and slit him open.
Everybody comes back out, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because children's stories, they don't like the end to really be the end. There has to be another day. But in Petronius, in the Satyricon, they bring out this pig. And the joke is that, oh, the pig hasn't been cleaned before it was cooked. And they cut it open, and what falls out are not entrails, but symbolic entrails, sausages, millions of sausages. And it turns out that was a really old joke, even in Petronius's time. It goes back to Troy. I mean, it's a long, noble tradition of slitting things open and having other goodies fly out. 4 and 20 blackbirds, whatever. Nobody wants a recipe.
What about popular literature, like Hannibal Lecter?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, Hannibal Lecter is a really interesting character. First of all, he's very sophisticated. When I first saw the first Hannibal Lecter movie, Silence of the Lambs, and at the very end, he says, I'm having a friend for dinner, and you know it's the really obnoxious guy from the asylum, and the audience cheered. I'm thinking, what's happened in this culture that the cannibal is the hero? I thought that was really fascinating. I was telling somebody else earlier that line about fava beans and a nice Chianti, That's the way it came out in the movie. In the book, he's a much more sophisticated person, and he had a nice Amarone. But I think Chianti sounded better in the movie. And plus, more people in the audience would actually know what Chianti might be.
But it's interesting that Anthony Hopkins played Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
And in another film, The Road to Wellville, he played America's quintessential vegetarian.
Yes. Yeah. Right, right. Another thing about Hannibal Lecter, when I say he's really interesting because we think of him as a kind of hero, is his name. Lecter means to read. He's us. You know, we're the readers. You know, so we're supposed to identify with him. So. Hannibal? Well, it just rhymed. It just sounded good. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think Hannibal had anything interesting except his name for the story. Yes.
What do you make of that recent lurid case about the
cop? Oh, you know, I was telling Kathy, if you get a reputation for being interested in this, everyone in the world sends you news clippings all day, every day. I didn't really find that case to be that interesting. You know, maybe because I'd seen so much of it at this point, but. You know, people think that it's very unusual for something cannibalistic to happen in modern life, but there are cases all over the world. You know, in Poughkeepsie, a teacher murdered a student and cut off his genitals and cooked them in front of him and ate them. You know, this happens all over the place. It's weird. You know, in Germany, somebody volunteered to be killed to be eaten, you know? There was, we were talking about the Donner Party before. There was one guy was the only one who got really bad press afterwards. He wound up opening a restaurant in San Francisco. The parallel to that is there was a cannibal in France, Issei Sawagawa, who's a Japanese who was living in France. And under French law, if you're insane, you can't be tried, right? So he was deported back to Japan. And they wanted to try him, but they couldn't because of double jeopardy. He'd already been released on this other thing. He became a food critic. So you know, we like our celebrities, whatever kind of celebrities they are. Yes?
How long was it that Jeffrey Dahmer was in prison before he was
killed? Before he was killed? A couple of years. A couple of years, yeah. I don't even know if that was the reason. I mean, he was a strange person. I mean, that might have been enough. Yeah. One thing. Yeah, I was very interested in Dahmer because he actually fit several of the categories. He was an exo-cannibal in the sense that he ate people out of his group. A lot of them were young Puerto Ricans and things that were not part of his Midwest waspy background. But he was an endo-cannibal in that they were all gay. He was a symbolic cannibal in that he kept parts of them. He kept their hearts and stuff in the refrigerator, because he loved them and wanted to be able to keep them, some of them inside himself, some of them in the refrigerator. He was a weird mixture of things. several years ago, they wanted to auction off of all of his stuff, including barrels that he kept flesh in and all this stuff. And some group of businessmen decided this stuff should not get into general circulation. So they bought it all and destroyed it all and would never tell anybody where the remains were. So, you know, it's sort of like what we did with bin Laden. Yes?
It's quite different psychologically between cannibals and in a society where cannibalism is accepted.
Of course. Of course, yeah. All the way back to Herodotus, he talks about what would happen if you went to an ordinary Greek and said, burn your father and eat him. You know, oh God, so disgusting. And then if you went to some tribes from farther east and said the same thing, they would be horrified that you were not eating him. You know, you know, that how could you disrespect him so much as to destroy him and not eat him? It's all context. Montaigne wrote the same thing. In the early 16th century, some of the first cannibals were brought back to England, and Montaigne interviewed a bunch of them. And what struck him was that we thought it was so horrible that they would eat their few enemies that they killed in battle, when we killed huge numbers of people in battle and just left them to rot in the fields. Which one of those things is really worse? So again, it's all context. Is there a good meat restaurant nearby?
I'm sure there's a nice piece of mature meat. Gary, thank you.
You're quite
so
welcome.
Much.
Thank you.